A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Wheels touch the tarmac in Athens. The seatbelt sign dings off. You grab your bag, shuffle into the jet bridge, and legally speaking, you've just stepped into a space that exists in law but not on any map. Daniel's been thinking about this ever since that passport scare in Greece. He wants to know where the border actually is when you fly in. If passport control is the administrative border, where are you between touchdown and that booth? And he's got a specific hypothetical. Say you lose control of a luggage cart and injure an airport employee before you've been admitted. Can that employee sue you? Are you subject to the country's laws? And does this whole fiction of being between countries create any real bureaucratic weirdness? Or does the law just smooth it all over?
The luggage cart hypothetical is perfect, because it forces the question out of the abstract. Most people never think about this gap until something goes wrong in it. And what I love about Daniel's question is that it's not just, where am I? It's what can happen to me here? Those are two very different questions.
So today we're going to map the invisible border, the one that exists in law but not on any map. And we're going to find out what can happen to you on the wrong side of it.
And the core puzzle is strange. International air travel creates a physical gap that law has to paper over. You're standing on the soil of a sovereign state. You're breathing its air. You're using its jet bridge. But you're not, legally, present in that country.
Which sounds like a riddle a law professor tells at parties. The kind where the answer makes you want to throw your drink.
It does. And the standard answer most people get is that the border is passport control. Full stop. But that's a procedural fiction. It's true for immigration purposes, but it's not the whole truth. The real jurisdictional boundary is more layered. There's a concept called the sterile transit zone, or the international zone. It's a legal construct, not a geographic one. It's airside, meaning you haven't passed through passport control, but you're physically inside the terminal. And the word sterile there's doing interesting work. It implies a space that's been cleansed of something, in this case, cleansed of legal presence.
Which is a very strange thing to say about a space full of people, shops, and overpriced sandwiches.
Stranger still when you realize the sterile zone is a place where you can spend hours. You can eat a meal, buy a souvenir, use the bathroom, fall asleep in a chair, all while not being anywhere.
So we're going to trace this in layers. First, where the border actually is, and it's not the runway. Then what laws apply in the gap. Then the edge cases that test the fiction. And whether the whole thing is as weird as it sounds, or just mundane with extra paperwork.
Let's start with the deceptively simple question. Where is the border, really?
Because I think most people assume it's the moment the plane crosses into a country's airspace. Or when the wheels hit the ground. I certainly did before I started looking into this.
Neither, as it turns out. The framework for this was laid down in the Chicago Convention on International Civil Aviation, 1944. It established the distinction between landing rights and admission to territory. A country can grant an aircraft permission to land, that's a landing right, without granting any passenger the right to enter. The two are legally separate. Think of it like being invited to someone's driveway but not their front door. You can park the car, but you can't come inside.
So the plane is admitted. You're just cargo that hasn't been processed yet.
That's not far off. The border, for the passenger, is the passport control booth. That's what some scholars call the fourth border. You've crossed the geographic border, you've crossed the airspace border, you've landed, but the legal border is that booth. And between the aircraft door and that booth, you're in a zone that's physically within the sovereign territory of the state, but is treated, for certain legal purposes, as an extension of the aircraft's jurisdiction.
Which is a phrase that sounds made up. Extension of the aircraft's jurisdiction. Like something a bureaucrat came up with at 3 a.m.
It absolutely sounds made up, but there's case law. The UK case R versus Martin, 1952, a passenger committed a crime on a plane still in flight over England. The court held that jurisdiction attached when the plane entered UK airspace, not when it landed. The aircraft is, in a sense, a floating piece of the departure country's jurisdiction until the door opens. And even after, the airside zone inherits some of that ambiguity.
So the border moves. It's not a line on a map, it's a procedural gate that you walk through. And depending on where you're in the process, the border is in different places for different purposes.
Right. And the U.S. courts have been even more explicit. U.S. versus Davis, 1975, customs agents searched a passenger in the sterile zone before passport control. The Ninth Circuit upheld the search as a border search because the zone is, quote, the functional equivalent of the border. That phrase, functional equivalent of the border, has become the legal standard in American jurisprudence.
Which means the border isn't where the map says it is. It's wherever the law says it's convenient for it to be. That's a remarkably flexible piece of geography.
And that functional equivalence cuts both ways. If the zone is the functional equivalent of the border for customs searches, it's also the functional equivalent of the border for other purposes. The state isn't surrendering sovereignty over that zone, it's just choosing, as a matter of administrative convenience, not to treat you as admitted for immigration purposes. It's a polite fiction. The state is saying, I could exercise full authority over you right now, but I'm choosing to wait until you reach the booth.
Which is a very strange kind of self-restraint. The state is voluntarily limiting its own recognition of you, but only for certain things.
And that selectivity is where all the interesting problems come from. Because the state isn't limiting its authority, it's only limiting its acknowledgement of your presence for immigration purposes. For everything else, you're there, and the state knows you're there.
So let's get to Daniel's luggage card. You're airside at Athens. You grab a card, it gets away from you, and breaks an airport employee's ankle. The employee wants to sue. You haven't been through passport control. Are you subject to Greek law?
The short answer is yes. The longer answer is yes, and here's why. The foundational principle here goes back to Schooner Exchange versus Mafadden, an 1812 U.S. Supreme Court case. It established that a sovereign state has plenary jurisdiction over its own territory, plenary meaning complete, absolute. The airport terminal is Greek territory. The fact that Greece hasn't admitted you yet for immigration purposes doesn't mean it's waived its ability to apply its laws to you. Immigration status and legal jurisdiction are separate questions.
So the border fiction is a one-way door. Greece can reach out and grab you legally, even if you haven't walked through the booth yet. But you can't necessarily reach back and claim Greek protections in the same way.
U.S. versus Pizzaruso, Ninth Circuit, 1968, affirmed that territorial jurisdiction extends to crimes committed in airport customs areas. The court didn't even blink at this. The reasoning is that the state's interest in maintaining order on its territory doesn't depend on whether someone has filled out a landing card. If you commit a crime on Greek soil, Greece has an interest in prosecuting you, full stop.
Which makes intuitive sense. If you assault someone in the jet bridge, the country isn't going to say, well, technically you're not here yet, so we can't do anything. That would be absurd.
Right. And there's a real case on this. 2019, a passenger assaulted a flight attendant in the jet bridge at JFK. The court held that the jet bridge was within U.S. territorial jurisdiction, even though the passenger hadn't been admitted. No one seriously argued otherwise. The judge basically said the jet bridge is attached to American soil, the victim was on American soil, and the defendant was standing on American soil when he threw the punch. Case closed.
I love how the law sometimes just looks at a complex jurisdictional puzzle and says, no, come on, obviously.
Sometimes common sense does win. But let's dig into the assault hypothetical a bit more, because it reveals something interesting about how the law thinks about space. If you assault someone in the jet bridge, you're charged under the laws of the country where the airport is located. But what if the assault happens on the plane, before the door opens? Now you're in a different jurisdictional space, the aircraft itself. And depending on where the plane is registered and where it was in the air when the assault happened, you might be charged under the laws of the departure country, the destination country, or the country of registration. The Tokyo Convention of 1963 tried to sort this out by giving primary jurisdiction to the state of registration, but it's still messy.
So the same physical act, punching someone, falls under different legal regimes depending on whether you're in C-24A or standing in the jet bridge, even though you might be 50 feet apart.
50 feet and one door. That door is doing an enormous amount of legal work.
So for criminal law, the answer is clear. For civil liability, Daniel's luggage cart, it's slightly trickier, but the answer is still yes.
The employee is on the job, so workers' compensation almost certainly applies, regardless of your immigration status. That's the most likely outcome. The employee gets compensated through the workplace insurance regime, and the question of suing you never arises. But if the employee wanted to sue you personally, the key question is whether the Greek courts have territorial jurisdiction over the incident. And they do. The tort occurred on Greek soil. The victim is in Greece. You are, at that moment, physically in Greece. The court can assert jurisdiction.
The practical barrier isn't jurisdiction. It's that you're probably going to be removed from the country before a lawsuit can be served.
That's exactly the nuance. The state can assert jurisdiction, but the practical question is whether it will. Most airport incidents involving non-admitted passengers are handled administratively. Detention, removal, maybe a fine, rather than through civil courts. The passenger is typically put on the next flight out before any lawyer can draft a complaint.
So you can be sued. You probably won't be. Not because the law can't reach you, but because you'll be gone before it gets around to it. It's a kind of practical immunity.
Which is its own kind of weirdness. The law is fully capable of holding you accountable, but the logistics of international air travel make it impractical for anything short of a serious crime. And this creates a strange category of person, someone who's legally reachable but practically unreachable. It's like being in a courtroom where the judge can see you, but the bailiff can't find you.
And that's the thing about this whole zone. The law is clear on jurisdiction. The state owns the ground you're standing on and can do what it wants with you. The fiction is for immigration purposes only. But that doesn't mean the fiction doesn't create real weirdness elsewhere.
Right. So the law is clear on jurisdiction. But let's look at where the fiction actually breaks down.
Because the International Transit Zone is a legal fiction, and legal fictions have a habit of colliding with reality in ways nobody planned for. They word beautifully on paper, and then a human being does something the paper didn't anticipate.
The cleanest example is the airport refugee problem. Under the 1951 Refugee Convention, a person must be within the territory of a state to claim asylum. Seems straightforward. But if you're in the transit zone, are you within the territory?
Depends who you ask.
Depends entirely who you ask. The European Court of Human Rights dealt with this in Almour versus France, 1996. Somali asylum seekers were held in the international zone of Paris, Orly Airport, for 20 days. France argued they weren't on French territory, so the normal protections against arbitrary detention didn't apply. The court said, no, the international zone is French territory. Holding people there for 20 days without legal process was a violation of their rights.
20 days in an airport? That's not a legal obstruction. That's a room with chairs and vending machines and fluorescent lights. 20 days of fluorescent lights.
And the court recognized that. The ruling effectively said you can't create a rights-free zone by declaring it an international area. The territory is the territory. You can't wish away your human rights obligations by putting up a sign that says International Zone. The fluorescent lights don't care what you call the room.
But not every country sees it that way. You mentioned the UK and Canada take different approaches.
Starkly different. The UK has historically treated the transit zone as not being UK territory for asylum purposes, meaning someone who claims asylum before reaching passport control isn't considered to have entered the UK and can be removed without the full asylum process. Canada, by contrast, has held that the transit zone is territory for charter rights purposes, meaning the full protections apply the moment you're on Canadian soil, admitted or not. Same physical space, same legal question, opposite answers.
So the same physical space, an airport corridor, is legally one thing in London and another thing in Toronto, which is a remarkable thing to say about a corridor.
Which is exactly the kind of bureaucratic weirdness Daniel was asking about. And it gets stranger. There was the Minsk Protocol incident in 2014. A Belarusian activist was arrested in the transit zone of Minsk Airport. The government argued he was on Belarusian soil and subject to Belarusian law. International observers argued the transit zone had a special status that should have protected him. No clean resolution. The ambiguity was the point.
The state gets to have it both ways. The zone is territory when they want to arrest you, and it's not territory when they want to avoid obligations. It's a legal Schrödinger's box.
That's the cynical read, and it's not wrong. But there's also a more mundane layer to this. Most of the time, the law just finds a way. Criminal jurisdiction is almost always asserted. You can be arrested in the transit zone for assault, theft, drug possession, anything. Civil jurisdiction is trickier but typically gets resolved through the airport's own liability regime. The airport operator is the deep pocket, not the passenger. The border fiction mostly matters for immigration and customs, not for general law.
So the weirdness is real, but it's also contained. The system has absorbed it, like a building that's settled onto its foundation at a slightly wrong angle, but nobody notices because all the doors still close.
Except in one area where the fiction matters day to day. International transit passengers, people who have a connecting flight and never leave the airside zone. They're technically not admitted to the country. This creates real issues.
Like what?
Serving legal process, for one. You can't be subpoenaed if you're never legally in the country. If someone wants to serve you with a lawsuit and you're in the transit zone at Heathrow waiting for a connection to Singapore, you're effectively unreachable. The papers can't be served because you're not, in the eyes of the law, present. You're a ghost.
That's a loophole you could drive a truck through. If you knew someone was trying to serve you, you could just book a long layover and camp out in the duty-free zone.
It is, and it's not theoretical. There are cases where parties have tried to serve process on individuals in transit zones, and the courts have had to grapple with whether service was valid. The answer is usually no. And it's not just lawsuits, it applies to subpoenas, court orders, even some forms of official notification. If the law needs to hand you a piece of paper and you're in the transit zone, the law has a problem.
What about customs duties? If goods in transit aren't imported, does that mean the transit zone is a duty-free paradise?
It is, and that's by design. Goods that remain in the transit zone aren't considered imported. That's why duty-free shops exist airside. The entire duty-free industry is built on the legal fiction that you haven't entered the country yet. Billions of dollars in commerce, all resting on the idea that this corridor isn't really here.
I never connected those dots. The bottle of whiskey you buy at Heathrow isn't imported into the UK. It's sold in a legal void. You're buying something that, legally speaking, never entered the country whose airport you're standing in.
A very profitable legal void. And here's a fun detail. If you buy that whiskey at Heathrow and then miss your connection and have to leave the airport and enter the UK, the whiskey suddenly becomes imported. You now owe duty on it. The legal status of the bottle changes because you walked through a door.
So the same bottle, in the same bag, carried by the same person, goes from duty-free to dutiable because of a door. That's almost poetic.
There's one more layer, diplomatic immunity. Transit passengers may have different status depending on the country and the treaty. Some diplomatic personnel in transit have argued that they can't be detained or searched in the transit zone because they haven't entered the host country's jurisdiction. The results are mixed. Some countries respect this argument, others don't. It's another place where the fiction gets stretched.
You've got asylum seekers in limbo, duty-free shops in a legal void, subpoenas that can't be served, and diplomats arguing about whether they're really there. A surprising amount of work for something that's essentially a corridor with carpet.
Yet most of the time, it holds. The law finds a way. The system is weird, but ultimately mundane. Airport security handles the incident, insurance pays the claim, the passenger gets on the next flight, and nobody thinks about the jurisdictional puzzle underneath.
Which is a kind of magic, honestly. Millions of people pass through these zones every day and almost nothing goes wrong. The fiction holds.
The mundane reality is that the border fiction is mostly a paperwork problem. It matters for immigration stamps and customs forms. For everything else, the state just asserts jurisdiction and moves on. But that doesn't mean the fiction never breaks. And when it breaks in ways that reveal how strange the whole system really is.
I think we need someone who's actually stood in that gap. Someone who's been the human face of the border fiction.
1997, Heathrow Terminal 3. My job title was Sterile Zone Compliance Officer.
What does that even mean? Sterile Zone Compliance Officer sounds like something from a dystopian novel.
It meant I stood in the corridor between the arrival gates and passport control and made sure nobody wandered through the wrong door. There were doors that led to the landside area, baggage claim, arrivals hall. If a passenger went through one of those doors without being admitted, they technically entered the UK illegally. My job was to stop that happening. I was a bouncer for a border that didn't exist yet.
You were the human embodiment of the border fiction.
I was a man in a high-vis vest explaining to confused travelers that they were in the United Kingdom, but not in the United Kingdom. Most of them just stared at me. One German businessman asked if that meant he could commit a crime and get away with it. I told him to keep walking. He looked disappointed.
Did anyone ever test that? Actually try to commit a crime?
Not on my shift, but I did see the system break down in a way that stuck with me. Passenger had a heart attack in the transit zone, collapsed right outside the duty-free shop. Paramedics arrived within minutes, and then there was a 10-minute argument about which hospital to take him to. The issue was that he hadn't been admitted to the UK. If they took him to a UK hospital, was the NHS responsible? Or was he still technically in transit, meaning the airline was on the hook?
Who won that argument?
The paramedics stopped arguing and just took him to Hillingdon, which is what you'd hope would happen. The medical need overrode the legal puzzle, but the paperwork afterward was a disaster. The hospital tried to bill the NHS. The NHS said he wasn't a UK patient. The airline said he wasn't their responsibility because he was off the plane. It took months to sort out. Eventually, the airline paid.
Because he was technically in transit.
Because he was technically in transit. And here's the part that made me think about this for years afterward. After that incident, the airlines at Terminal 3 started doing something. If a transit passenger looked unwell, really unwell, they'd rush them through passport control, get them admitted, stamp the passport. Now they're the NHS's problem.
They were gaming the border to shift the cost, using the legal fiction as a financial tool.
A passenger having a heart attack in the transit zone costs the airline money. The same passenger having a heart attack in the arrivals hall costs the NHS. So the incentive was to push sick people across the line as fast as possible. I watched it happen more than once. You'd see an airline staff member practically jogging a pale, sweating passenger toward the immigration desk.
That's a perverse incentive created entirely by the legal fiction. The airline isn't being cruel. They're responding rationally to a rule that says a person 10 feet on one side of a line is their financial responsibility, and 10 feet on the other side is the state's.
The line was a strip of yellow tape on the floor outside my booth. That was the border. Yellow tape. I used to stare at it during slow shifts and think about how absurd it was that this piece of adhesive determined who paid for your heart attack.
People's medical care depended on which side of the tape they collapsed on.
For about 18 months, until someone at the Home Office noticed and changed the policy. Now there's a memorandum of understanding. Any medical emergency in the transit zone gets treated by the NHS and billed back to the airport operator. The loophole is closed. But for a while, it was real. I saw it with my own eyes.
That cost-shifting loophole is exactly the kind of mundane weirdness that makes this whole topic so satisfying. But it also raises a question for the future. As biometric entry systems and contactless borders become more common, does the physical border fiction become obsolete?
The direction things are moving is toward what they call seamless borders. Your face is scanned at the departure gate. You're pre-cleared before you even board, and by the time you land, you've already been admitted. Australia's been experimenting with this. Singapore's rolling it out. The transit zone shrinks to nothing. You step off the plane, and you're already in the country.
If you're admitted before you deplane, where does that leave the sterile zone? Does it just become a corridor?
It becomes a historical artifact. The legal puzzles we've been talking about, the asylum cases, the jurisdictional questions, the duty-free loophole, they all depend on there being a gap between arrival and admission. If that gap disappears, so does the fiction. The yellow tape on the floor becomes just tape.
Which is probably a good thing for clarity, but I'll miss the weirdness. There's something almost charming about a system that works perfectly most of the time while resting on a foundation of legal make-believe. It feels very human. We built this enormous global infrastructure, moved millions of people through it, and never quite agreed on where they're while they're in it.
The law's ability to paper over conceptual gaps is impressive, but the gaps are real. And every so often, someone falls through one. An asylum seeker stuck in a terminal for 20 days, an airline rushing a sick passenger past a yellow tape line, a bottle of whiskey that's legally nowhere. The border is wherever the law says it is, until it isn't.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. It helps other weirdos find us.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running and for the yellow tape story. I don't think I'll ever look at airport carpet the same way.
This has been my weird prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.